This is a no-brainer. Speculators, if they're just buying paper and they're preying on misery, that is not why that commodities was set up.
Senator Begich makes the case that oil speculators are driving up gas prices. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the Smithsonian returns human remains and funerary objects to Shishmaref, Gamble, and Savunga.
So these would have been like everyday objects that traditionally would have been buried with men and women when they passed away.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com.
So far, all efforts to curb speculative trading in the oil futures market have run into partisan opposition or are hung up in the courts. Democrats in the U.S. Senate have sponsored several bills to put limits on how much oil can be held by any trader for the purposes of buying and selling to profit from price fluctuations. Senator Mark Begich is a co-sponsor and enthusiastic supporter of that legislation. He says speculators are running the price of crude oil up far beyond what would result from simple supply and demand.
They estimate for every gallon of gas that you and I and your listeners put into their car, 56 cents is speculators. Unbelievable. So we have a piece of legislation to get speculators out, unless you use it for end purpose, meaning, like I said, freight companies, so forth.
The bills are going nowhere, however, because they don't have bipartisan support. They have become politically entangled with other oil and gas issues, particularly the Obama administration's push to end federal tax subsidies for oil companies, which is adamantly opposed by Republicans. Additionally, such a law already exists. 2 years ago, in the Dodd-Frank Act, Congress directed the Commodity Futures Trading Commission to enact what they call position limits on how many oil contracts traders can hold on to. But the regulation the commission passed to do that was immediately challenged by the industry in court. That case is still pending. Senator Begich says everywhere he goes in the state, people are urging him to take action to curb high fuel prices. This morning on the public radio call-in show Talk of Alaska, he said the situation is probably the same for other lawmakers during their holiday trips back home.
This weekend, Memorial Day weekend, all these senators are going to come back come Monday, right? What do you think they're going to have heard all weekend? Gas prices. I'm like going, yay, now maybe we'll get some people who can join us. Because this is a no-brainer. Speculators, if they're just buying paper and they're preying on misery, or they're just consuming the market to hold us, you know, wait for us consumers to pay the ransom, that is not why that commodities was set up.
Begich is among a group of Democratic senators who have involved themselves in a legal case against speculators.
We've joined, and I say we, I, and other senators have joined a group suing over this issue because these speculators have no business in this market.
The speculation issue has not always been so partisan. Back in 2008, with the price of crude oil approaching $140, Republican Senator Ted Stevens introduced a bipartisan bill to limit positions held by certain types of investors. He said in 5 years, the amount of crude oil futures held by market index funds had skyrocketed. The bill was never passed. The Smithsonian is returning human remains to Shishmaref that were excavated more than 80 years ago by a fur trader, and the native villages of Gamble and Savunga will receive 72 funerary objects that date to the Great Famine of the late 1870s. KNOM's Ben Matheson has the story.
The remains of an estimated 48 people will come back to Shishmaref this summer, along with 6 funerary objects associated with burials. The remains of about 27 people were unearthed at the old village site of Shishmaref in 1926, plus more in 1929. Dr. Lars Krutak is the repatriation case manager.
They came to be in our possession through a series, well, of archaeological excavations and also gifts, but they've largely stemmed from a non-indigenous fox trader George Goshaw, who established a fox farm there, basically on the site of Old Shishmaref and part of its cemetery in the 1920s. And so he cleared away these sort of burial berms, like sand, little sand mounds, where individuals were traditionally placed. And he cleared them to make room for his fox cages and basically where he was raising these Arctic foxes for the fur market. He sent several of the remains to us, and then we had Smithsonian archaeologists in the region in the 1920s, and he basically gifted them to these individuals, and that's how they came to be at the Smithsonian.
In addition to the human remains, six funerary objects will go back to Shishmaref.
So these would have been like everyday objects that traditionally would have been buried with men and women when they passed away, objects that may have been used in the afterlife, you know, once the spirit has migrated. So like scrapers, ivory bola weights, projectile points, that type of object. So sort of utilitarian objects.
Stanley Toktu is the Shishmaref IRA president. He will be going to Washington, D.C. to pick up the objects and remains this summer. The IRA and an elders committee are still figuring out what to do with the remains and objects.
We know this island's 4,000 years old, so it'd be nice to see our ancestors' hunting tools, survival tools, whatever they used during all four seasons, because we know Shishmaref is a subsistence community. We'd like to get most of the items back our ancestors used, you know, to a museum, at least get them back to Alaska where they belong, so they won't be scattered all over the United States and we'll have no trace of what our ancestors used.
The native villages of Gamble and Savunga will receive 72 funerary objects this summer. Dr. Krutek says that these are associated with people who died in the Great Famine of the late 1870s.
Which were collected originally starting in the late 19th century on expeditions. There are also sailors or members of the Revenue Cutter Service who picked up remains when they landed on the island or when they were conducting their surveys, and then they found their way here as gifts.
The Smithsonian also had excavations in the 1920s by curator Henry Collins. Researchers took 60 funerary objects from historic sites at Cape Gilligak at the southeastern end of the island in 1929, plus more from the Punic Islands. The museum returned a large number of human remains to St. Lawrence Island in the 1990s, then began work to identify and return the objects for this summer. The records of the devastating famine come from interviews with elders from the early 1900s. They told of weather conditions that caused the ice to be further offshore.
It just made it much more difficult for people to sort of get to the sea mammals, and it also had some effect on the ice flows and ice currents, which resulted in, you know, over 95% of the population of St. Lawrence Island sort of being decimated, and that sort of compelled the survivors to move to Gamble.
Krutek says the objects and remains are reminders of some of the most difficult periods in the Smithsonian's history, but he says the return of the objects can be part of a healing process. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, ADAC patiently waits for a new air carrier to serve the community.
We want to see the program succeed, period. We do know that there's pressure on the federal budget, and we want to do our part to make sure that this program continues.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority supports a statewide system of care for people with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcoholism and substance abuse, Alzheimer's, and traumatic brain injury. You probably know a trust beneficiary, a family member, friend, coworker, neighbor, maybe you. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, here for all Alaskans.
Several moose attacks occurred in Anchorage over the holiday weekend, and wildlife authorities are cautioning Anchorage residents to keep an eye out for aggressive city moose this time of year. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The two girls, ages 11 and 6, were playing in the street when the moose chased them. They ran to a playground to try to escape, but the moose caught them, stomping on the younger girl's back and arm, while the older girl was hit by some playground equipment. Anchorage police have indicated that the moose may have had calves in the area, but other reported moose attacks over the long weekend have wildlife managers concerned. The State Department of Fish and Game is cautioning people in the Anchorage area that late May is moose calving season, and that can mean that a cow moose with a young calf nearby can get aggressive. Jesse Coltrane is an area wildlife biologist.
Cow moose are very, very defensive of their babies, especially during this time period and for about two more weeks when the calves aren't very mobile. So they will actively defend them and very aggressively do so. And every year we have people that are injured. Usually it's people that are out walking their dog or running or biking or something that are injured. And we've also had a couple of unsubstantiated reports of some of different groups of mountain bikers on the single track trails in Kincaid being injured by moose.
Coltrane says single track mountain biking trails new this year in popular Kincaid Park are attracting bikers, but can be hazardous when it comes to wildlife encounters. She cautions bikers to be vigilant for the next couple of weeks and give moose a wide berth.
Cow moose with young calves are not going to move out of your way, so making noise might not necessarily help the situation. But if you're moving quickly and you come around a blind corner and you encounter a moose at close range, there is a very, very good chance that she's going to try as hard as she can to stomp you into the ground.
No word from Kincaid Park officials on biker moose encounters. State Fish and Game Assistant Director Tony Cavalock also cautions anyone seeing a young moose calf by itself to just leave the animal alone. Even if the little moose appears to be abandoned, it probably isn't. Cavalock says cow moose routinely leave their calves alone while they go off to feed. Human intervention can disrupt the bond between moose mother and calf, too, and contact with a moose calf poses a danger to humans.
It's not a good idea to touch a moose calf. If there's some concern or the possibility that it's an orphaned calf or mother's been killed or there's some other situation, then the best thing to do is call Fish and Game. The other part of it is, too, is if indeed the cow has been killed or died to some other cause and the calf is in the area crying, that may attract bears. And as you know, we have bears in the Anchorage Bowl, too. And you're running the risk of possibly tangling with a bear.
Cavalock says the best way to respond to a lone calf is to just leave it. Eventually, the mother moose will come back to it. Fish and Game has the legal authority to designate moose calves as orphaned. Some calves taken into captivity by state game officials are placed in zoos in Alaska and in the lower 48. The state has permitted the Alaska Moose Federation to rear orphaned calves placed in its care by state wildlife managers, although the AMF is not permitted to capture any moose at this time. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Department of Fish and Game has announced the projected outlook for salmon runs on the Kenai Peninsula. The numbers look a lot like last year. Fish and Game is transitioning to a new method of counting salmon on the river and in Upper Cook Inlet, which has left a lot of questions for both the commercial and sport fishing communities who are returning from a rough year in 2011. KDLL's Shaylin Cochran has more.
The big question from Wednesday night's public meeting in Soldotna was, how will Fish and Game count salmon this year? Well, they'll be using sonar, as in years past, but it gets a little complicated after that. A new technology called Didson has been in use by the commercial division, along with older split-beam sonar, for 3 years, providing a good baseline. The sport fishing division, however, is still trying to complete the transition, making it difficult for anglers in both camps to anticipate management decisions.
We understand they're scientists and they're trying to find better information. And there's a transition period from an old way to count to a new. Unfortunately, this transition has taken place during big sockeye returns. And last year, we paid the brunt of that. We lost opportunity to harvest. We had a window where we could have harvested 200,000 to 300,000 sockeye that stayed in that should have went away.
That was Robert Williams, president of the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association, a group advocating primarily for set net fishermen, speaking after the Fish and Game meeting. Last year, in an effort to get more king salmon into the Kenai River amid a huge sockeye run, some set net fisheries were shut down early and faced other restrictions, costing commercial fishermen opportunities at catching those sockeye. That's the balancing act Fish and Game must perform again this year, with king and sockeye runs projected to be similar to 2011 numbers. But that outlook and the continued effort to find more and better data, management decisions could look a lot like they did last year, says Ricky Geese, executive director of the Kenai River Sport Fishing Association.
I think last year was a unique year. We had a very large run of sockeye salmon coming back. So we have the set net fishery and the drift fishery out front, the commercial fisheries harvesting sockeyes. But we also want to have king salmon coming into the river. And we had a low abundance last year of king salmon. So how do you prosecute commercial fisheries at the same time trying to manage for conservation concerns for king salmon? And I think we're going to find ourselves in a similar situation this year.
Conservation of the resource both groups depend on is one area in which you'll find agreement. But again, how Fish and Game can do that equitably is what's on William's mind.
And if it's for conservation, we're fine with that. We don't want to hurt the late run Kenai River king salmon run at all. But we'd be a little more comfortable if we had a little more confidence in the counting.
Aside from the challenges presented by a transition to a new method of counting fish, the simple fact that kings are in low abundance right now, as they have been for several years, adds to the difficulty of making the decisions that will dictate how many salmon are harvested. Here's Geese again.
I think, they'll wait till about, typically around the June 10th is about the halfway point in the early run. Figure out where we are at that point. Is the run early? Is it late? We'll see how this all unfolds as the season goes.
Despite the Kenai River's reputation as home of record-sized kings, he says the sheer volume of sockeye expected to return should provide adequate opportunities for the sport fishermen.
I mean, that's why we're seeing kind of a shift in angler effort, I think, from king salmon in some ways over to the sockeye fisheries, the bank fisheries, because, when you get more fish out there, people are drawn to a river for fishing for it.
Fish and Game is projecting a count of about 4 million for the late-run sockeye fishery and a below-average range for king salmon of between 16 and 44,000 fish. Reporting from Soldotna, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
The search for an airline to serve ADAC is starting over. On Thursday, the U.S. Department of Transportation rejected the only bid it received for the federally subsidized flight route and reopened the bidding process. KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports.
After Alaska Airlines announced in February that it wouldn't try to renew its essential air service contract this year, the DOT put out a request for proposals. Penn Air was the only airline to reply. It proposed flying a 30-seat Saab turboprop to ADAC four times a week in exchange for a $3.4 million subsidy. That would have been the second most expensive EAS subsidy in the nation and double what Alaska Airlines currently receives for flying the route with a Boeing 737. The DOT wouldn't comment for this story, but in the order reopening the bidding process, it said, quote, "We're concerned that the level of subsidy Penn Air requests is very high," end quote. The Essential Air Service program was almost eliminated during federal budget cuts last year, and its spending continues to be highly scrutinized. ADAC City Manager Leighton Lockett says the cost factored into the community's decision not to support Penn Air's proposal.
We want to see the program succeed, period. We do know that there's pressure on the federal budget, and we want to do our part to make sure that this program continues.
ADAC's main concern, though, is that Penn Air doesn't have sufficient cargo capacity on its planes.
Unlike other communities, we don't have regularly scheduled barge service, so everything has to come by air.
The DOT says Penn Air's proposal does meet ADAC's historic cargo requirements, but Lockett counters that those numbers don't take into account the recently reopened Icicle Seafoods plant.
Fish drive traffic here, and, with the fish processing plant here, there's a lot of traffic moving out of here.
Lockett is optimistic that the second round of bids will generate proposals that address both the community's cargo needs and the federal budget's bottom line.
We're open. Obviously, we need air service, and so we'll be talking to anybody that calls.
Penn Air couldn't be reached for comment on whether it will be bidding again. Alaska Airlines says it won't be bidding on the route. Proposals are due to the DOT on June 26th, and a decision is expected shortly thereafter. In the meantime, Alaska Airlines will continue flight service to ADAC. Reporting in Alaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your healthcare provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet.
Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Residents in a few select neighborhoods in Sitka will be trying out a new kind of bear-resistant trash can this spring. The local sanitation company is doing a field test of two prospective containers. Both are mostly plastic, and neither is considered bear-proof. All the authorities want to do is frustrate brown bears looking for an easy meal in the hope that they move on. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
At Sitka's Fortress of the Bear, spring has definitely sprung. A seafood processor recently provided the habitat with 3,000 pounds of excess frozen salmon. This is good news for the five brown bears who live here and the at least 30 bald eagles and 100 or more ravens who have just dropped by for lunch. Last year, a local group known as the Bear Task Force arranged to leave a bear-resistant trash can in the fortress with a tasty treat sealed inside. Fortress co-director Les Kinnear describes what you probably already suspect happened.
We left one in the habitat for a couple days because they drug it into the pool. It's like they wanted to have more time to work on it. And they've since ripped it all to pieces. It was plastic, and they can destroy, you know, even substantial plastic products.
Kinnear would be the first to admit that it was not a fair test. The bears here are routinely given challenges to get their food. It's placed in a hollowed-out tree trunk or inside a buoy ball with a small opening. Kinnear calls them puzzle feeders. Last year's trash can test was not all that unusual for the two full-grown male brown bears.
So when our bears approach a trash can, they see that as another challenge. Now, a wild bear doesn't exactly see that. A wild bear is there because he's hungry, not because he's interested or playful. And his primary interest is in gathering food as economically as possible.
The can happened to be one that Alaska Pacific Environmental Services is using in this spring's field test in Sitka, though the lid is now made out of custom welded aluminum instead of plastic. APES, also known locally as Strager Sanitation, is deploying 24 cans in two varieties, one a manufactured bear-resistant can with a locking lid, and the other, the more conventional can with the aluminum lid. Andrew Tomes, who sits on Sitka's Bear Task Force, stresses that neither is bear-proof.
I think the cans are going to be bear-resistant. They're not going to be a can that a bear can just walk up to, open up, and reach in and grab the trash. Or they're not going to be a can that a bear can walk by, knock over, and garbage spills all over the street.
The theory is that bears, working mainly in the limited hours of darkness, won't want to invest the effort.
If a bear wanted to get into the can, it could spend some time doing it. But if it spends 20 hours out there trying to get in the can, you know, by that time, the police or ADF&G can see what's going on and chase the bear away.
Phil Mooney, the local wildlife biologist with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, agrees.
Especially with young bears moving through, they can tip them over. But if they can't get into it, it's very typical for our bears to hit and run. They, you know, knock it over, grab something out of that, and then go to the next can.
Mooney is pretty certain that, like the bears in the fortress, we're not just training wild bears to a higher level.
No, we're going to be able to respond. One of the issues is by the time dispatch gets the call, by the time, you know, they can respond and we can respond, sometimes the bear is, you know, two blocks away and moving. They're quick to learn that an easy meal is nice, but they're not going to spend a whole lot of time there and draw attention to themselves.
Mooney, along with police, is the front line of Sitka's response to bears. In 2009, bear calls peaked at over 200. 19 bears were destroyed or removed from the area that summer. Calls tapered significantly in the last 2 years, but Mooney expects it to start to creep up again.
We're going to see more bear activity this summer than we did last year, and it's slowly increasing as those voids that were created in the landscape out there and habitat will be filled in by other bears.
The new cans have been placed at homes in the Indian River neighborhood, Sitka's primary bear corridor, the Cascade Street neighborhood, and at both ends of the road system. In September, Alaska Pacific Environmental Services will survey customers to see which cans they preferred and how they worked out. APES is footing the bill for the field test. Andrew Tomes with the Bear Task Force says if it's a success, his group's next job will be to figure out how to bring more cans to town and how to deploy them. There may be some efficiencies in buying cans with Juno, since APES is contemplating a similar trash system in that city. Les Kinnear, meanwhile, says his bears are happy to help out if more cans need to be tested in the future.
That's the nature of the beast, is to be inquisitive. They got to be bears by being very, very strong and clever and powerful and capable.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A new book tells the story of a Fairbanks woman who set a standard for adventure and conservation activism. Boots, Bikes, and Bombers is a compilation of Ginny Wood's stories and photos. The book, put together by University of Alaska Fairbanks oral history researcher Karen Brewster, recounts Wood's unique adventures, like bike touring Europe and sailing the Northwest coast back in the 1930s and 40s. Wood also flew in the Women's Air Force Service pilot program during World War II. After the war, Brewster says Wood and friend, fellow pilot Celia Hunter, flew surplus planes from Washington to Fairbanks.
They left Seattle in December 6, 1946. They arrived in Fairbanks January 1st, 1947, because the weather was so bad, they could only fly 4 days. And Ginny tells these great stories about her plane didn't have heat, and her radio only communicated out, and Celia's only communicated in, so they could send messages, but they couldn't really talk to each other. So they had to fly very close to each other, and they had signals that they used. It's a great adventure story of how they got to Fairbanks.
Brewster says the trip was supposed to be brief, but Wood and Hunter liked Fairbanks and stayed. Wood became a backcountry guide, started Camp Denali with Hunter, and helped found the state's first environmental organization, the Alaska Conservation Society, working many of Alaska's major land and resource issues.
Very influential in stopping Project Chariot and Wolf Control and the Rampart Dam. Ginny and Celia were very involved with lands getting set aside under the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act.
Brewster says Wood's long pursuit of simple living and protecting the earth remains an important lesson today. The 94-year-old Wood still lives in Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Shaylin Cochran in Soldotna, Stephanie Joyson on Alaska, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. How do you get men to wear a life jacket when the fact is that 90% of those who die in boating accidents in Alaska are men? Well, most men won't listen to this message, but they might listen to you. So have them pledge to wear a life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Have them fill out a Pledge to Live card at pledgetolive.org. That's pledgetolive.org. Make them promise so they make it back home. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.